Moto Casino, American Social Casino.
Welcome to Moto Casino, where the excitement never ends, with thousands of the hottest free-to-play social casino games, fastest payouts, and the best promotions in the industry. No tricks or gimmicks. Owned and operated in the USA.
Moto Casino is a free-to-play social casino. No purchase necessary. 21 plus to play. Void where prohibited.
Sign up today for a generous welcome bonus.
Moto Casino, American Social Casino.
Download the Moto Casino app today.
COTA has turned up the frequency. Buses are running more often across Central Ohio. Starting this September, you'll see expanded weekend service on the east and north sides, including the Easton and Polaris corridors. Plus, there are added weekday trips downtown from New Albany, Canal, Winchester, and Tuttle. It's more service, more connections, and more ways to move across the city. Discover the enhanced schedule at COTA.com/service changes. That's COTA.com/service changes.
Transfer drama, defensive errors, and defeat. It's like Norwich City have never been away. Welcome to the latest edition of the Pinken.com Norwich City podcast. I'm Connor Southwell, joined by Paddy Davitt and Samuel Seaman to dissect, reflect, pick through the wreckage of what was quite the opening day for the Canaries at the Kassam Stadium yesterday, a 2-0 defeat. And goodness me, sometimes there are podcasts and you hit record and you think to yourself, I don't know how we're going to fill an hour today. Today is whatever the opposite of that is, because we've got so much to talk about. We obviously did a preview podcast at the end of last week, and I asked the guys how excited they were heading into the new season. I think both of them ranked themselves around a 6. So, Paddy, on the basis of everything that unfolded yesterday and everything that we saw, do you want to upgrade or downgrade or stick with your excitement level?
Just building the tension. Trying to find out something on probably something we're going to debate that's actually just started to sort of move as we recorded, but we'll get into that. No, I'm definitely not upticking from 6, I think I was at, because if the criteria is drama and soap opera, then yeah, definitely off the back of what happened at Oxford's Kassam, or rather what didn't happen in terms of a certain individual and his lack of availability. But if it's how excited, what was the actual question again? How excited or how?
I think it was how excited are you for the new season was the question at the time, wasn't it? So
I'll stay at 6, Connor. I'll stay at 6 for now.
What about level of dread? I'm sure that's maybe increased, but we could debate that. We could debate that all day long.
You know, as you said, Connor, in your intro, you know, there's. You'd probably rather have too much to get your teeth into than not enough. So if there's going to be plenty to get our teeth into as we go forward in the next 9 months, good and bad, then bring it on.
Yes, where to start? I think we should probably start with the football, and then we'll talk about the stuff around it. Sam, it was a 2-0 defeat. I was reading earlier, it's the first time a newly promoted team coming up to the Championship has won 2-0 on or by 2 goals on the opening day since 2010. And the I guess concerning thing from a Norwich City perspective is probably how comfortable it was, and the fact that it probably wouldn't surprise any of us if we were speaking about a scoreline that was significantly worse than the one we are talking about.
Yeah, it was a pretty poor performance on a number of levels, really. And I think it underlined to me the fact that we can talk all summer about the need for patience and the fact that eventually, you know, a big blow is going to come and the Norwich fans are going to have to deal with that, and it's going to be about the reaction to that. But when you're actually there and you're at the Kassam on the opening day, the Sky Sports cameras are there, the fans are amped up for the start of the season, and then they put in a performance that bad. That really does make it real, and that does almost still feel slightly shocking, even though we've talked about the need for patience for the whole summer and since this sort of rebuild started, really. But yeah, it was a pretty comfortable afternoon for the team that won the League One playoffs last season, and that's certainly not an encouraging sign going forward. I actually thought it was interesting on my way out of the stadium to go and speak to fans that the way Oxford fans were talking, you know, given this is the height of where they've been for a really, really long time, their first second division match in over 25 years, you'd have thought they would have been absolutely buzzing about their own side's performance, but most of what I heard was actually shock at how bad Norwich were, and worries for maybe the fact that they might even be in a relegation battle themselves. So I think that tells you a lot about the performance. I didn't think Oxford needed to be great to get that win, although tactically I thought they were pretty smart and they denied Norwich a lot of what they wanted to do. I don't think there were too many absolutely spectacular performances. What it basically was inactivity from Norwich, inability to penetrate that Oxford defence, and then errors at the other end to allow simple goals for the home side. And if you're Johannesov Torup watching that, and obviously he's been working with the players for the whole of the summer at Colney, he's seen a lot of pre-season friendlies, and a lot of that wasn't especially encouraging, but I think he's seen in high definition now quite how big a job is on his hands for the rest of this season, because individually, collectively, tactically, technically, there were so many issues about that game and so many worries for Norwich fans that I think he's got a lot of work to do this week. And it's, to be honest, across the board, it's every single department in that team, and that's what went wrong for Norwich. So yeah, it's difficult to see where they go from here. I'm sure that's a debate we'll have. One positive is that he'll have learnt a lot of lessons. But just looking at that game as 90 minutes, it was nearly as poor as they come from a Norwich City perspective.
Yeah, I was trying to rack my brains, actually, because Norwich don't have a great record on opening days, it is. And obviously, in terms of poor performances, that's about as bad as I can remember since, obviously, the infamous 7-1 against Colchester. Because, as you said, Sam, it wasn't just a defeat. It was the performance and the manner of the defeat in terms of the approach. I think a lot of Norwich City fans heading to the Casal, I can't obviously speak for all of them, and I would certainly never try and do that. But I'm sure there was a constituency of Norwich fans who probably travelled there wanting to see at least some sort of structure, some sort of evidence of what they had been building up the last 6 weeks. And obviously there's mitigation, and we'll get into plenty of the mitigation as the podcast rolls on. But I think, Paddy, the element that will be most concerning is just how devoid of anything they looked in terms of ideas, in terms of structure, in terms of ability. I don't want to say effort, but I think there probably will be a lot of people maybe saying effort. So it's you can understand why probably those positions have been taken from Norwich fans of real concern, probably waking up on Sunday morning and throughout their trips home last night.
Well, exactly. I mean, Sam mapped out quite well. I mean, it's a continuation of pre-season, really, which, if you want to pick one word out, patchy in terms of performances, in terms of results as well. But that was pre-season. And in your mind's eye, you're probably thinking, whether it's internally, Johannes and his coaching staff and the players and the sports staff, and externally ourselves or those fans, particularly the 1,500 who were travelling to Oxford for a lunchtime kickoff. That's pre-season. That was kind of, it didn't really matter. The intensity levels weren't there. The kind of sense that this is for real wasn't there. We'll see a lot different at Oxford, but it was a continuation of a theme. And that is concerning, because now we're underway and we're off and running. And it still feels very much early stages of a work in progress, which you would think 6-7 weeks down the track. And you're right, there is mitigation and fresh waves of it yesterday before a ball was kicked. But for me, that isn't enough to excuse the anemic offering that we saw from that team, and a team that were more than good enough in terms of the constituent parts to come away from, yes, what were Oxford? Everything you'd expect a newly promoted side, particularly one who had not been back at this level for 25 years. They were hungry. They were energetic. They were aggressive in their pressing. There was an optimism and an excitement around the stands. It was palpable. You could feel it walking into the ground. This was a big day for them, big moment in their club. But that was all a given. You knew that was coming. But in terms of quality, I don't think they particularly had to do too much to get the better of Norwich. And that would be very worrying, that the Norwich looked so far second best against the newly promoted side. It's quite understandable for me, the reaction. The reaction at full time, very loath to put a figure on how many of that 1,500 or so were still in the ground, to be fair, but of those who were still in the ground, how many very audibly and visibly as well, in terms of sort of hand gestures, were expressing their dissatisfaction as Johannes and the players all headed over to try and show their appreciation. And game day one, 90 minutes into a 9-10 month journey, and we've got that, dealing with that, it's not a good place to be. And it flies in the face of, we've turned the dial, this is a definitive break, this is a new era, to sort of paraphrase what Ben Napper said when he unveiled Johannes back in May. And of course, you know, get a bit tired now of talking about patience acquired, and this is a turnaround. And, you know, when we sat down with Glenn in Austria, and was it turning around a tanker in a, or a ferry in a
ferry lake? In a lake. Yeah, ferry
you
in a lake.
You need to check that one out, Connor. But, you know, that sentiment, all that's a given. Fine, no problem at all. But show more than they showed at Oxford, even with the events that unfolded on the morning of the game. That isn't going to get the job done. And that's why I think the reaction has been as stiff as it has been, both in person, those travelling fans, the reaction on social media. You know, I saw a stat just now before we started to record. I think 9 or 10 of those who started the game yesterday were in and around it last season. That's not a turning of the dial. That's the tried and trusted, and unfortunately, a group of players who haven't performed now over a number of seasons. And okay, you could shoot back, well, they got in the playoffs, didn't they? And yes, they did, but they were a long way short of Leeds in those playoffs, and they never realistically looked like they were going to, for long spells of last season, be really in the promotion shake-up. It was all for, almost for me, they got there by default. It was Josh Sargent, it was Gabby Zara dragging them along, really. So let's not kid anyone. That group of players have underperformed for a number of seasons, for a number of different head coaches, and the evidence yesterday, the fresh evidence, was those issues still remain. And now, quite rightly, I think we're rapidly approaching a crossroads, and we saw maybe signs of that. You know, Grant Hanley, and that's not to single out Grant Hanley particularly, but he's a visible representation of the past, should we say. And him getting hooked in the second half, albeit it was
Jacob, like a moment, didn't it?
Yeah, albeit it was Jakob Sorensen who went on rather than maybe Brad Hills. But, you know, is that the start? Is that the start? You know, along with Onel Hernandez not even making the matchday squad. You know, I think we'll start to see an acceleration, because one thing I'm pretty sure of now, having had enough interactions with this new head coach, he's not going to come here, sit on his hands and accept the status quo. I think he will now look to shake it up. There was a lot of talk yesterday after the game about culture, and that it's not in the right place, and that they need to dramatically change that. And I think that process will get accelerated now, because he's not come here and left what he left in Denmark to find himself, you know, firefighting and treading water in the Championship with a group who aren't fit for purpose. So if anything, maybe there is an upside to what we saw yesterday, and that is, it's an accelerant to a process which has started, you know, a little bit more incrementally maybe for a lot of Norwich fans. But I think you will see now pick up pace, along with obviously the twin track of between now and the end of the window. I think it's going to be very busy in and out. And that, again, will be a very visible sign, as well as what hopefully starts to unfold on the pitch, that this is different. No, stay with us, row in behind us, no pun intended. And hopefully things will be better in short order. But from what we saw purely on the pitch at Oxford, I don't think there's any signs there that this is going to change anytime soon.
No, couldn't agree more with what you've just said. And two buzzwords I'll pick out of that: culture and firefighting. And both of those elements feel very pertinent this morning for Johannes Hoftorup, I'm sure. But just to come back to that point that Paddy raised, Sam, and I think this is an element of perhaps why that frustration bubbled over in the away end, because, as Paddy said, that dial hadn't really been turned. A lot of what we saw and felt yesterday didn't feel that new at all. As Paddy said, it was only Callum Doyle, wasn't it, really, who was fresh from that group of players. You had Liam Gibbs, who, you know, we spoke about a lot on this podcast last season, but he wasn't a regular in the team last year. Christian Fashnacht, signed by David Wagner, of course, wasn't a regular in the Norwich City team last year. And of course, to be fair to him, wasn't due to start the game until probably an hour or two before. So, hey, I'm not sure how much blame we can attribute to that. But it's more the general narrative there that these are players, as Paddy said, that they have watched, the fans have watched, we've watched, make mistakes, deliver performances that aren't to the standard that people would demand. And that probably is the element of frustration, because, and I kind of felt this would happen at some point, probably didn't expect it to happen so soon, that there would be this crunch point of probably what's gone before to what's needed to move forward. And it feels like it's happened very early with quite a few of those individuals. But from a fan perspective, do you think that encapsulates why there's so much frustration around this performance? Because it didn't feel like what they'd been told, really, in terms of a new project and a new identity and a new approach.
Yeah, I think when you have so many common denominators in terms of the players who are on the pitch, you have to show something completely different in terms of the performance and the tactics and the way that you're setting up and trying to go about things. But I, off the top of my head, and I'm pretty sure this is accurate, there's only one time they actually passed out from the back under pressure, moved the ball quickly up the pitch and found themselves with space in the opposition half as a result. And given that's the sort of philosophy and the theory behind the whole Johannes Hoftorp blueprint coming to Norwich City, that really is quite disappointing. I think fans, even if it wasn't especially successful, wanted to see that sort of football from minute one to minute 90, to be honest, not for 30 seconds halfway through the first half. And that's where the problem lies for me, because you need either a complete change in personnel so that people can see that team and know that something different is happening, or you need a complete change in the football. And neither of those really happened. You take that one very small passage of play out and it could very well have been a David Wagner team, and not even a good performance in a David Wagner team. It would have been one of the worst performances that Norwich produced last season. So the limited signs of change, I think, were what left those Norwich fans so disappointed. And I think the majority of them are willing to be patient and are willing to recognise the fact that one defeat on the opening day of the season doesn't mean there won't be any signs that this football is starting to come into the team, and that the players are starting to understand that. And I think a lot of the debate among fans, and maybe some of the criticism that some of those supporters have had for others who are in the ground at the Kassam, has been where there's a focus on the short term and the long term. But I think you can look at both and say that actually in the long term, this doesn't mean that the project is a failure and that Torup's football isn't going to be a success at Carrow Road. But in the short term, it can still be a bad performance that could have been far better, even if there were a load of mitigating circumstances and it was the start of a process that could take a little while. So I think that is why there was so much dismay around the performance, and why fans are hoping to see something different in the next couple of games. But yeah, I can understand why it will take time and why those players haven't completely got used to it yet. But for me, it would have been more encouraging if they had been trying to play that sort of football. It probably would have been more encouraging if they had lost 3-0 and actually spent the whole game trying to play out really intricately and quickly from the back and given Oxford a goal with a sloppy error in that sense, than it was to see them playing quite a lot of long balls, not looking especially dynamic in their movement in front of the ball. And until Emmanuel Forsen came onto the pitch, they didn't really have many representatives of the sort of football that they're going to try to play this season. So that's where I think the problem was yesterday. But equally, I don't think it means there won't be signs going forward, even if it does look like it may well be results-wise a pretty long season.
Yeah, again, agree. Which probably leans us on to where perhaps a lot of the focus has been in terms of the squad yesterday, or at least to me feels that way, Paddy, which is the centre-back pairing of Grant Hanley and Shane Duffy. As we said, when Hanley got pulled off, which was, you know, Norwich captain on the day, whenever a captain gets pulled off in the second half and it's not injury-related, and also a defender, we know coaches, as a general rule of thumb, don't like to change back fours in games because of the sort of continuity and the importance of solidity from the back. So it was a big moment, but equally, that is a partnership that if Norwich City are going to play in the way that Sam just described, we've got to be brutally honest about, haven't we? And just say Jose Cordoba's out and he clearly would play if he was fully fit. But that is a centre-back pairing isn't going to lead Norwich City into the type of era or playing the type of football that I think Norwich fans and probably Torup himself wants.
No, absolutely not. And that was more evidence, but I think we've seen that in pre-season, the games at Hanley or Sorensen or Duffy when they've been permed, that intrinsically, Sam mapped it out, that is the guiding principle for how Torup wants to play a football. It is your two centre-backs, your three midfielders, the connection between those five players. If it doesn't work, then for me, Torup's system doesn't work, because you see how isolated Sargent was, for example, Science, Fashnacht as well. it just becomes structurally imprecise. It doesn't work. So if that is the case, and to be honest, let's broaden it out. It wasn't just the two centre-backs yesterday. Those three who start in midfielders, Liam Gibbs, Kenny McLean, Marcelino Nunes, poor in possession. So sluggish as well. The turnovers as well, the aggressiveness of the press that Oxford put on them in numerous occasions where they got turned over. Wayward passing. There was one instance, I made a note of it actually. I'm going to test test my notes here. It was about 43 minutes in, and it was basically Nunes, no pressure at all. Sainz was wide out on the left and he's carved it, big diag, and it's gone completely over his head and out of play. And you just think, you're better than that. We've seen you're better than that. You're far better, a technical player than that. What is wrong that you cannot make something that should be in your wheelhouse in terms of a pass? But so for me, it's more of a broader point. Has he got the right five players in there? And the answer clearly for me isn't. You bring in Callum Doyle, you talk about, as he did, what do you value about Callum Doyle? I asked him on Thursday. His passing, his ability to pass the ball. Well, don't stick him out wide on the left. I mean, there was a period in the first half where he was actually finding space wide left, and Duffy and Hanley were incapable of actually getting the ball to him.
He was screaming, wasn't he? His arms were up in the air.
So exactly. So what's he make of that? Yeah. If you brought him in because, again, he fits a centre-back who is able to comfortably take the ball in tight areas and pass it through to midfielders who can then thereon move the ball quickly through the thirds, then get him in the right positions on the pitch. Cordoba obviously wasn't available. Doesn't sound like he's going to be fit either for Tuesday. But as soon as he is available, get him in. For me, it would have been far better yesterday to go Doyle in the middle of the park, centre-back-wise, and then play Kellen Fisher at full-back. And I think it certainly wouldn't have been any worse. And I think you'd have seen a far better structural setup. But no, I think it's pretty evident now. Shane Duffy and Grant Hanley are not the prototype centre-backs in a Johannes Torup system. So we're in a bit of a holding pattern, I think. And to go back to my previous point, I think that might be accelerated now with Hanley getting hooked yesterday. It'll be interesting. You know, we hope Cordoba is fit and available for Blackburn. Just final point, Connor. And then if he is, then for me, you've got to get him in. You've got to get Doyle in his right place, because I don't think he's a fullback. I think he is a centre-back. I think his lack of pace will be exposed in wide areas. And you saw evidence of that, I thought, on occasion against Oxford. And just play players in the positions they're comfortable in as individuals, but more importantly, in a system-led coach, which Torup is. It's almost, it's the cliche, but it is a lot of square pegs in round holes at the minute. It feels that way anyway.
Yeah, well, I was going to come back to you, but I'll fire it on to Sam. What did you make of Grant Hanley's reaction? Because I think, you know, we were in the stand, and I mean, he had a face like thunder on him, didn't he? Well, I don't think he was best pleased. And I guess this gets to the crux of the point, really, and to maybe coin a Daniel Farker expression. It does feel a little bit like Norwich are paying for the sins of the past here, doesn't it? In terms of players who are just immovable. I mean, I've had people in the live blog, you know, speaking about some of those experienced players, and why can't you just get rid of them? It's like, well, you need someone to buy them and take on what are pretty hefty contracts. And Hanley's got a year left, Duffy's got 2 years, and I don't want to single out these two guys because there are others in the team as well. And you know, there's been a lot of talk about balancing experience with younger talent, but equally that experience has to have a value, and the experience cannot be the only value. There has to be a playing footballing value as well to complement that in order for him to extract it. So just on that point. But in terms of Grant Hanley's reaction, because as Paddy highlighted, that did feel like a moment. I mean, it immediately felt to me, and Daniel Farke had a similar moment, I think it's fair to say, at Millwall away, didn't he, with Russell Martin. And ironically or unironically, I don't know, Norwich then moved to sign Grant Hanley to take that position and take the project forward. What did you make of Grant Hanley's body language and whatnot as he marched off the pitch, Sam?
I wasn't especially surprised, because I can't imagine that's a situation he's been in many times in his career. And on an individual level, I can imagine it was quite a painful moment for him. Quite a frustrating moment for him, and I can completely understand his reaction. But as a moment, on the whole, it felt like something that Norwich needed, to be honest. I think that moment almost gave fans a little bit of an assurance that actually Torup knows what's going wrong here, and he knows that maybe there does need to be a slight changing of the guard. But the issue is where you go forward with that, because one of the primary concerns for me was that initially he turned to Jakob Sorensen. He had Brad Hills on the bench, of course, and I think he's the man that most fans wanted on the pitch from the start, let alone as your first substitute for a centre-back halfway through the second half. And I think having seen a lot of Sorensen at centre-back this pre-season, most will recognise that that isn't going to be where Norwich get the best out of him. It's certainly not a position where they can really rely on him to be a first choice. And, you know, as you've mapped out there, it's very easy to say Grant Hanley isn't good enough, Shane Duffy isn't good enough, they can't be part of the project. But it's also, what do you do with them? Because, you know, as you said, there aren't going to be many who are willing to pay the wages that they will demand. And if you have players like that around the building who have a lot of influence, who obviously are leaders and they're unhappy, that is not going to help the change around in culture that Paddy referenced earlier and that Norwich really do need. I think it would maybe shift the balance of power in Torup's direction a little bit, but the mood in the dressing room would be destructed if you just completely rooted out those older, more influential players. And then it doesn't really look like the depth's there. It doesn't look like Torup feels he's got enough players behind Hanley and Duffy to really populate that centre-back area for the rest of the season. Because I think, although Cordoba was injured, that sort of mapped out how fragile squad building can be at times. Because as soon as he gets injured, if you aren't having Hanley, you aren't having Duffy, you've got to choose from Jakob Sorensen, Brad Hills and Jaden Warner, realistically, currently in the building. Doesn't look like he trusts Hills to start right now or to be a regular starting option in that position. We've all seen Sorensen's weaknesses in that position. And I think, you know, Warner is another one who I think he's only played 3 or 4 championship games in his career. So it's all well and good saying that these players need to come out and that they can't be part of this new era for Norwich. And I think we've all seen the evidence as to why. But right now, unless Ben Napper goes out and signs 3 pretty good centre-backs for not a lot of money before the end of the transfer window, who do you put there instead? And I think that underlines why there may well be a bit of a transitional period for Torup, why the squad isn't exactly where it needs to be right now, and why this will take time. Because as it was with Farker, you do need a couple of seasons to get that churn and to get the sort of squad that's able to play that football. And right now, although it did feel like a significant moment in Grant Hanley's, I don't know what the right word is for it, but in terms of his long-term future at Norwich, it felt like a significant negative for him and his chances of playing regularly. But equally, who has Torup got to turn to that he really trusts? Right now, it feels like not many options, to be honest.
Yeah, and I also think for Torup, and you mapped it out very well there, it's like you have to pick your battles coming in as a new head coach. He's got, and we can see it, we used the word firefighting earlier, which may well end up being the title of this pod, actually. But he's got enough fires to be trying to put out without then starting another one with some of his senior players. So it's really difficult. And I guess this, Paddy, all comes back to culture, doesn't it? And this is probably where we can now begin to speak about Jonathan Rowe, because there does, rightly or wrongly, at this moment in time, and I've spoken to quite a number of Norwich fans at the moment, or in the last 24 hours or so, basically since Oxford, you know, just kind of asking them, what did you think of it? What did you make of it? And a lot of them have said, you know, have spoken about the fact that there was a team there that consisted of a lot of players that, again, looked disinterested. And we don't know for sure. You'd have to go through all the players individually, probably catch them in a very private moment to know that for sure. But when you see Gabriel Sarra being sold for big money, you see Josh Sargent, who there is interest in, has been interested in, will be interested in. John Rowe, obviously not there, and we'll get onto him individually in a moment. There are others in that squad that we know who are either unhappy or feeling a little bit wobbly at this moment in time. That doesn't add up to a culture that is in a position where it's ready to then be taken forward on a little bit of a journey. And this is part of the issue, isn't it? And maybe we go back to the Glenn Rinner's own quote of turning a ferry in a lake. It does feel a little bit of that at the moment.
Oh, absolutely, and a lot of it, let's be honest. And it's just been magnified now with the blow-up around John Rowe and his desire to sit out that game or his request directed to Giannis. And before we get into the reads of that, I mean, obviously we're hearing this from the club's perspective. John Rowe, as yet, probably wisely, hasn't taken the social media to put his side across. But, you know, that is the communication from John Rowe, from the club side on the John Rowe episode. But to zoom out a bit, when Giannis is, as he was post-match, talking about the culture's wrong, that's much bigger than one individual who's rogue or two or three individuals who want out the club. You know, that's almost an endemic problem. And he's only been in the building 6 or 7 weeks. And if he's now feeling six, maybe a little bit longer, to be honest, but maybe 2 months in, if he thinks now that there is a cultural issue within that dressing room. And I'm going to be very clear now, I've got the quotes in front of me. This is, you know, this is actually what he said around culture. We have to build an environment based on players that have the desire to perform for Norwich wherever we play, because that's important. And also for everyone around to respect, it's important that a club cannot be run by too many players, player power. Not ones where their ambitions are to go somewhere else in the middle of a game day. We have to build that culture. We have to build that environment because it needs to be even stronger. That's where my focus is. He could not be clearer. He feels there is a cultural problem in that dressing room, maybe more broadly in the football club, in the football side. And he is focused now on improving that culture and building an environment that is where it's all about the collective. It's all about Norwich first. You know, we talked about Farke liberally in this podcast, the Nelson Oliveira one. I've seen that pulled out because that was an opening day of the season. And Farke's response after, in the days after, it's the name on the front of the shirt, not the name on the back of the shirt. A very prosaic, but underline the point. And we're back here again.
We had, just to jump in, the club released it was like a little mini doc, wasn't it, of pre-season. And there was a clip of Torup in there and he was speaking to the squad. And I'll have to find the exact quote, but it was something along the lines of those who want to shine individually are going to be found out. And it's those who want to shine as part of a collective that are going to drive it forward. So if that is his messaging, it's very clear as to how he sees that culture working, isn't it? It's about, as you said, similarly to Farke, probably the we and not the I.
Absolutely. And that's why I'm sure, you know, the actions of John Rowe, as reported through the club, would have cut deep, because that isn't about the we. That's about the I. Let's get it straight. And the timing of it was horrendous, that whole episode from sort of Friday afternoon onwards and how that played out. And you can understand Giannis. I mean, he kept it well hidden, but the frustration he must have felt that you know, what was for him a big day in his very embryonic career as Norwich's head coach was completely overshadowed. As he said, of course, it had, you know, it had to have had an impact on the players. And, you know, that's not an excuse, because we've just dissected where we think, you know, on the pitch, they are failing at the moment, albeit very early on still. But there's no doubt also that was a factor, that whole episode. And that's why I think we've, you know, maybe indirectly, Johnny Rowe has achieved one thing, and that is to actually now bring forward some very tough decisions from Giannis and in order to put the foundations in place that culture is there, that environment is there, where players want to come in, work hard, be proud to represent Norwich City Football Club and put Norwich City Football Club first and not themselves. And obviously that's, you know, we live in a world, particularly professional football, that's probably not the case when push comes to shove, because it is, you know, players have to quite rightly look after themselves. It's their career and they have to, you know, they have to take decisions that benefit their own career, but there's a balance. And again, he referenced the example of Gabby Zara yesterday after the game. There's a way to do this. There's a way that chimes with what he's trying to build, but also you're looking after yourself as an individual and your family and the people close to you. And, you know, Max Aaron's further back in times gone by. There's plenty of examples in and around Norwich City squads where players have maybe felt their time has come to an end at Carr Road in a yellow and green shirt, but they've not looked to move on in a way which is detrimental to them and how they're viewed by the fan base, but also the football club as well, more broadly. So, you know, my fear is that he probably didn't want to take on these type of battles this early. I think he probably thought he had enough on just embedding how he wanted the play, the style of play to be. And that was going to almost have to be his focus in these first few months, maybe even this first season. Unfortunately, I think he's probably realised now that before he even gets to the actual intuitive, this is a Johannes Thorup team in and out of possession, he's going to have to actually think, no, I've got to start with the culture and the environment. And if that means moving players on, then so be it. But how much can you achieve of that between now and, you know, the end of this window? The reality is it's probably going to overhang into a January window next summer. And the challenge is to do all of that work, which he clearly feels now is lacking, while still on the pitch, having a team that are moving forward, picking up results, playing in a style, which is what he wants to develop at Norwich City. So a tough job, it feels, has got very tough indeed for him after the events of Oxford.
Yeah, and increasingly in my mind, is all of those players that we've referenced, all of those ones who maybe see their future elsewhere or whatever, they're not all going to go this window. So again, you're going to have to, I know people have kind of spoken about the unwanted sort of unnecessary instability that having a transfer window that overhangs the start of the season creates, and it does, absolutely. But equally, the fear is that then bleeds beyond that, because as we said, Paddy, not all of those players are going to go. So that becomes very, very difficult. To zoom in on John Rowe slightly then, Sam, and as we say, he obviously in the hours ahead of this, in this game, I'll do a proper timeline of it. So Friday night there was the first report from Fabrizio Romano about Marseille making a formal offer that had sort of developed from earlier on the day, murmurings, and I think we reported it as well of interest from Marseille that then stepped up in the evening. Again, then there was a wave of stuff from us about that bid being absolutely nowhere near the levels of where Norwich City wants it to be, which is how it currently sits as far as we're aware. I don't think we've had any update to suggest that situation has moved on as of 12:15 on Sunday. And then come Saturday morning, obviously we arrive at the Kassam Stadium, and I think, you know, it's fair to say, and we've said this elsewhere, there were murmurings on the Friday night that this was how it was going to play out. And to be honest, at that stage, because of the type of character John Rowe is and the type of player that he is, I didn't really quite believe that was the way it was going to pan out. But at some stage in that morning, between obviously the waking up and the team travelling to the Kassam Stadium, John Rowe knocks on the door of Johannes Hoftorup and says, I'm not playing, I'm not in the right headspace or whatever, and withdraws himself from availability, having Norwich City having worked all week with him in the squad, him having been due to start the game. I've been trying to rack my brains since the full-time whistle, really, which is, you know, 20-odd hours ago, to try and understand from John Rowe's perspective and the people that represent John Rowe why this move now would be the right one to take. And I'm really struggling, to be honest. I can't see a situation where, as we said, at the moment, it's only Marseille who have made a formal bid. There's obviously been lots of chatter around Leeds, but from what we gather, that was a 30-second conversation around the value that was completely apart, and that hasn't progressed since then. So that's my question for you, really, Sam. Why do you think he, his representatives, those who look after him, have taken this decision? Because I can't really make head or tail of it.
That's a good question. And this one, I'm afraid I'm about as lost on as you are, to be honest. Even purely removing all of the sort of principles around it and the way that Norwich fans will feel about it, and the idea of honouring a contract and all these sorts of things, purely from a cold analytical perspective of whether it's going to help him push this move over the line, it is a bit bizarre because, as you mentioned, it's not close to a deal being done. Nobody has got anywhere near, really, the valuation that Norwich have for Jonathan Rowe as a player. It's not like there, you know, there's a few hundred thousand in it, and Rowe is just trying to push Norwich, give them one more incentive to accept that bid and try and get that deal over the line. You know, it's not an Adam Eder situation that's been playing out for ages and has been deadlocked for a really long while. It's something that first picked up, I think, around the start of this week and hasn't progressed too far down the line of a deal being reached between clubs. So I certainly think it's way too early to go for the nuclear option, which is to rule yourself out of playing. And whoever's given him that advice, I'd have to say, probably hasn't made the right decision, as far as I'm concerned. And obviously, you don't have to always take the advice of people around you. It's not just about what you're being told to do. And people need to have their own individual principles and their own individual ideas about how they want to approach things. But equally, Rowe's never been in this position before, where he's been a senior player who's wanted by clubs to go straight into their first team. And yes, we know what a talent he was when he was a young player, and there was a lot of interest in him from various clubs when he was coming through the Norwich Academy pretty much throughout. But in this situation where you're in the public eye, there's going to be multi-million pound bids that will affect both clubs in a really big way. It is his first time in this situation, and I wonder if he's just so desperate to make that move happen that he's not sure what he can do as a player other than rule himself out of contention. Of course, you could try and engage your agent to try and push the club a little bit more. But as far as options that you have as a player, there's not much you can do apart from sit tight and hope that it happens. And as a young man with ambitions, maybe it's just that he doesn't feel he has too many options to actually influence the possibility of him leaving the club. But I don't see why he's gone this early on such a serious decision. And even putting that aside, I think it's a significant way to let down the club, the people who have supported you through your career, who have helped you develop as a footballer, who have guided you through the academy and given you a first team opportunity. It's a way to quickly ruin your relationship with fans who absolutely adored him until literally 2 days ago. He was the favourite player of probably most fans after Gabriel Sara's departure. And instantly, overnight, almost all of them have turned on him as a result of this decision. And it does baffle me, to be honest, as much as it baffles you. And I'd be surprised if any of us can find anywhere close to an answer as to why he's decided to make this decision, especially at this time. But overall, I think it's just a massive disappointment for those fans who will feel let down, because they've been the ones buying the tickets, contributing ultimately to his wages. And that's another point that I haven't even brought up yet. You know, if you're under contract, employed by an organisation, you have to go to work. You have to do what you're employed to do. And that applies to everyone across society, let alone footballers who are paid way more than most of us. And it is disappointing on a number of levels, and I can understand why those fans feel so hurt by it. But purely trying to look at it from a cold, strategical point of view, because that is what football is ultimately, it is a business. But even from that point of view, it's hard to explain why he felt now was the right time to do it.
Yeah, and that go, you know, you look at that timeline as the way that I've mapped out in terms of factually what happened, and obviously there'll be different gaps that both sides and both parties, I'm sure, would fill with different points of conjecture. But those are the things that publicly we know about. And it is very hard to look at that timeline, I think, in my view, and feel that this wasn't premeditated, from the way that report of a bid was put out there to then not playing. That whole episode feels premeditated to have made an impact at probably the point at where it's going to make maximum destruction and raise maximum attention. That's what it feels like to me. Obviously, it's difficult without Jonathan Rowe coming out here and putting out his side of the story to say that, but I'm saying that based off the facts that we have available. But the thing is that I can't get my head around, Paddy, is that basically ever since he's come into the Norwich team, he's had to deal with speculation. Even when he was a young player in the academy, he had to deal with speculation. Okay, we can debate at what levels that those speculation were at. And, you know, I know that because I've asked him about sort of contractual statuses before in situations, and he's always been pretty good at not avoiding the question, that's the wrong way to use it, but playing the straight bat that I think we know that footballers are taught and trained how to use in terms of their answers. So this is the bit that I just can't get my head around, because you've got a player there who, as we've mapped out at the moment, has been one bid for. It's not a great look, really, when you know, as Sam said, he's manoeuvred himself into a position where, you know, and I know there's been a lot of traction in terms of one social media post that, that was from November last year, where he just put "die for the badge" in capital letters. It's really hard at the moment in this situation to look at that as anything but insincere. And I think that's what supporters will feel really frustrated by, because as Sam said, ever since he's come through, he had a really, really good opening 6 months where he made a really real name for himself. Then he had injury problems in the second half of last season. But they've adored him. They've loved him. They've given him an environment not just to succeed, but also to make mistakes as well. And that's largely because of the personality, because of the way he's crafted, you know, his image, really. So that is probably where Norwich fans will feel most disappointed. And then as well, we can get into the point at which he's done it, as I said, which feels like it was done to really blow up everything for not just him, but for his teammates, for his head coach, and for the football club that have nurtured him through really difficult times for his young life. All of that, when you add it up as an equation, feels really disappointing.
Well, that's an understatement, Connor. Yeah, no, it's a slap in the face, really. And again, you know, this is a transactional relationship. You know, it's not John Rowe owes Norwich nothing in the sense that he's performed and now he's a valuable transfer asset for that football club. But by the same token, you know, Norwich did give him that opportunity, did, you know, have a duty of care to him on a very difficult academy journey on and off the pitch. And, you know, it's sad that it gets to this point now. And, you know, I mean, I asked Giannis, has he been badly advised? Because I can't think he's making these decisions on his own. You know, he has people around him. But
he can say no. I think that's a point worth making as well. No. I know they have a lot of power and agency, you know, not to avoid the pun, over these players. But, you know, equally, there must be some sort of moral compass that kicks in that where, you know, John Rowe or any player goes, no, I'm not going to do that. I'm not going to refuse to play for a club that's pushed me through, or any club, really.
Well, as I say, until we speak to John Rowe, then, you know, I don't want to be putting words in his mouth. But I think it's very hard. No, I sort of tend to disagree there, Connor. I think for these young players, the people they have around them now, because it is quite daunting. If you're John Rowe and you're going into contractual sort of discussions and you've gone from, you know, kicking a ball about at Colney in front of, you know, a handful of people at development level, you know, to suddenly you're projected onto this huge stage. You know, you're a Derby hero and all the adulation that comes with that. You know, you're an England under 21 international. You're rubbing shoulders with some of the best young players in England. That all turns heads, you know, the awards, you know, shortlisted Young Player of the Year alongside the likes of Archie Gray in the Football League last season, all of that, if you've not got the right people around you and you can remain grounded and retain a sense of perspective. And I'm just surmising here, but the chain of events that you two chaps have just mapped out, none of that screams to me he's getting the right advice, you know, to play this out in this regard when, unless we're being told different, the reality is there isn't a viable bid on the table for John Rowe as it stands now. So, you know, we're not in an end game scenario. This isn't Adam Eder and Celtic and we're throwing him in because he conversely was available and came on and I thought played with a purpose in the second half yesterday. So again, it goes back to there's a way to do it. And of course, you know, he had his missteps in Austria and we know all about that. But, you know, that's one scenario, but it's very different to the eve of the opening game of the season when you're travelling with the squad, you're in the camp, you've trained all the way through pre-season, trained well, scored goals, look like you're going to be a big part of this. You're in the side and then you announce that, you know, you're not in the right frame of mind or you request not to play. I wouldn't want to shovel all this on John Rowe's shoulders. Yeah, of course, you know, he has to control his own career. It's his career at the end of the day and it's his destiny and he needs to shape that. But you have to remember he is a very young man who has had a lot come quickly and he needs better people around him, I think, because now, ultimately, it's very hard to see how this gets resolved satisfactorily where he leaves now with, you know, with the best wishes of everybody concerned. And that's a sad state of affairs that, you know, I think when the dust settles and it may be later on in his career, he will look back at this episode and know that he got it wrong and he didn't act the right way. But young people in all walks of life, they have to learn the hard way sometimes. And just unfortunately, his mistakes are magnified because of what he does for a living and what he means to the fan base. Because on his journey, he has been perfect, really, all the way through, building that connection with the fan base, coming across as a genuine, caring person who just loves playing for Norwich and going out there and doing his stuff and expressing himself on the pitch and the way he plays. And that joy that he brings to people and to himself, I'm sure. And all of that now, and sadly, you know, is probably going to be forgotten about. You just hope it does play out now in a way that he basically goes in this window, because I dread to think if he still stays in the building, how bridges are repaired and how he can be brought back into the fold and be a viable option. Because, you know, once you've gone to this level, I think there's only one way, and that is to get him out the door. And that's why you would hope now that those same people who are around him are able to actually do what they should be doing, and that is find him a viable move that also hits the numbers that Norwich want it to hit. Because I think, I'm pretty sure, knowing the people involved at Norwich, this will only stiffen their resolve now. I don't think this tactic, if it was designed to, I'll get him out, he's a bad egg, we'll just get him out, we'll take a cut price deal, I think it'll go the other way, and Norwich will now want value for that player. And they might find that the path becomes a little bit more complicated to getting him out of this football club. But you know, there's no winners in this scenario, and it's sad that it's going to end this way, probably. And John Rowe, unfortunately, now will be, for me, tarnished as a Norwich person, and that's not how it should have been. It should have been, he's one of our own. We've developed him. He's probably outstripped where the club is at the minute. That old, you know, sort of line that used to be thrown with Maddison particularly, you know, there'll come a point where the player, his progress is outstripping that of the club. So you shake hands, you get the best deal possible, and on he goes. And the reason I throw Maddison in it, because I know for a fact that he had people around him who strategically looked at, we know where James wants to get to in his career, we know how good we think he is, but what are the right clubs and the right environments? And right from when he was at Coventry, Norwich was deemed as the next step up, then Leicester. Now he's playing for Tottenham, you know, one of the biggest clubs in the country. That is how you should have a career guided for you, not being touted around like a commodity. And it's sad to see.
Yeah, agreed. And equally, it puts a hell of, you know, if I'm John Rowe now, I think I'm turning around to my agent, who again may or may not have played a significant role in this, and saying, right, buddy, you better back up what I've just done, because I've put a hell of a lot of faith in you and basically blown up my reputation at Norwich City, because you've told me that to do this, I'm going to get a move to Marseille or wherever. So he's now got to back that up. And yeah, that's why, again, from a strategy perspective, I'm really just struggling to understand why this option at this stage, where nothing is guaranteed, was the right one, was the right lever to pull. But there we go. And that probably, just to close off, Sam, that probably does end, you know, the debate probably ends with what next, because two things are going to happen. John Rowe either goes in this window or he stays. And if he stays, then that's a situation that he's going to have to be managed and managed really delicately. But equally for Norwich, as Paddy said, it puts them in a hell of a position, because you've got there an asset and a serious asset who clearly is worth a significant amount of money to them. So you need to deal with this in the right way. But equally, as we've discussed, you've got to also bear in mind that there's a dressing room there who will be watching, some players in particular will be watching with very close eyes as to how this all plays out, because you've got to limit this from happening again within your dressing room. It's a very difficult balance that they've got to strike to try and sort this out.
Yeah, I agree. And I think it puts Torup and Napa especially in a little bit of a difficult position, but also they may well have to look at it as an opportunity, because you want to establish a culture and you want to show what you're about in that sense. The way that they react to this situation will say a lot to those players that you mentioned about how important their actions are and what the standards are at Norwich City going forward. And I think there is still precedent for bringing these sorts of players back in. You know, people will remember the situation with Todd Cantwell and Emi Buendia at Bournemouth, when Daniel Farke chose to leave them out because he felt they had been sort of had their heads turned by transfer speculation, and ultimately both came back into the squad, both played significant roles in cities. Championship promotion that season and winning the title that season. Emi Buendia had one of the best individual seasons the club has ever seen. So there is a way that you can build players back up and get them back in that team, but you almost have to do it absolutely perfectly. And it does feel like the much easier situation, certainly, for Napa and Torup would be if they can find him the right club. But as Paddy said, I don't see the situation that unfolded yesterday changing Norwich's resolve. I don't see them just selling him for a cut price because they're worried about a bad egg. Because, you know, as I've just spoken about, in terms of the effect it has on other players, if you now send out the message that doing that makes it more likely that you get a move, any player who wants out, and, you know, as we mapped out a little bit earlier as well, we know there are a few in that squad who would be very open to a move away from Carrow Road this summer. That almost tells them this is the way to go and do it. So it's an incredibly fine balance that they have to strike now. And there is quite a lot of difficulty in there for those two at the top of the club. But equally, as I said, it's an opportunity to set that culture and to make a marker as to what you expect going forward. And if they can get it right, I think that will also be an important step in trying to change things around off the pitch and in the dressing room. So, yeah, I think there are positives and negatives, and there are ways to do it if it goes either way. But certainly the easiest option now seems to be making sure somebody pays what you want them to pay, moving Rowe on and getting a replacement in quickly, as they did with Gabriel Sara.
Yeah, and probably whilst that process is happening, removing Rowe from that first team group, because I don't see how you can have an influence like that in the around the place at this moment in time, particularly given all of the conversation that we've had on culture and whatnot as well. So going to be interesting to see how that unfolds. Obviously, our next point, next touch point with Johannes Hoff-Turup will be after that game against Stevenage. And I'm sure, not to write Paddy's questions for him, but I'm sure Paddy will ask him a John Rowe related question off the back of everything that unfolded yesterday, which, Paddy, to close the pod, is probably a nice way to end, because Norwich have another game on Tuesday night at Carrow Road, and it begins a run of three Carrow Road matches. Blackburn obviously at Carrow Road on Saturday, and then Sheffield United the weekend after. So we've got basically three games in a row at home. What does Torup do now for this cup game in terms of selection, in terms of approach? Because as we've already spoken about, that it's, you know, games and whatnot are usually utilised to get some of those players who don't get minutes in to get minutes. Does he continue down that path? Does he look to use it as an opportunity actually to get some of the same actors who were in on Saturday back in order to try and build those elements of what he wants to from a footballing perspective? How does he play it?
Funnily enough, I mean, how you've mapped it out, I just wanted to double check, because that was the final question we threw at him, because there isn't an actual separate Stevenage presser. So it was one or two supplementary questions. I'm sure that's what he wanted to be talking about, pitch side at Oxford yesterday, his approach for Stevenage. But he did answer along those lines. Off the back of what had just unfolded, this is an important game now. It's the first competitive game at Carrow Road, but they need to respond. And I think that probably will colour a little bit the lineup he would send out. I didn't get the sense, you know, maybe he was quite as enamoured with the cups as Farker was, who almost put on the same par as, you know, chasing league progress. But nevertheless, I don't get the sense now, off the back of Oxford and all the fallout that has unfolded, we'll get, you know, 11 youngsters. I think he'll have to mix and match again. And, you know, your mind immediately springs to maybe it's an opportunity for Forsen to get a few more minutes and a bit more understanding with the players around him. Brad Hills, we've discussed at length the centre backs. If he doesn't start on Tuesday, we might as well all stay at home. So, you know, Kellen Fisher, Krizeni, maybe if he's available, he's got a bit of a lower.
Well, yeah, I mean, you've basically started. Walk us through your team then. Who are you well, going for? Let's start in goal. George Long, isn't it?
I'd probably go Archie Mayer, if I'm honest.
Nice, you know, like that. Yeah, don't mind it.
Give him an opportunity. I mean, you know all about George Long, don't you? So, yeah. I mean, if you're gonna, we'll say Krizeni isn't probably ready to start. If he missed out on Saturday, it's not a huge turnaround time. Likewise, Cordoba. So, I'd probably go Warner and Hills, if I'm honest. I'd probably go those two. I'd probably go keep Stacey on the right and then Kellen Fisher on the left and midfield. definitely Forzan. Yeah, it's probably too bold to go Gabe Forsyth, isn't it? You know, good luck. Congratulations to that man. You know, one of, we think, the youngest debutants in many a year, 17.
Yeah, I'm just trying to get out. You go through your team, but I'm just trying to get.
Yeah, well,
you
just completely. I mean, yeah, I mean, I'd personally like to see Liam Gibbs get another go because I just think with him, I mean, he wasn't great Saturday, but he's missed a lot of football, both fitness wise and, you know, falling the wrong side of David Wagner's assessment of him. He needs to be playing again regularly. And I think if he is, he has the technical attributes that he could flourish under Torup. So I'd give him another go tomorrow. And then probably Nunes. I think he needs to put a marker down. And also, I think, again, Nunes, I just look at him and I think he should be perfect in this system because he's very good in tight spaces, taking the ball in, seeing pictures and moving it through the thirds. And I look at all those midfielders in the central part of the pitch now available to Torup, and he's the one who stands out for me as a player who fits the eye of what the Danes trying to do. And then I suppose your front three, you're looking, well, will we see John Rowe? We probably won't see John Rowe, I think. So I think we'll rule him out. But, you know, I'd like, you know, Kamara. I know there's a lot of talk around him and will he be out the door, but what's to be lost by giving him an opportunity? You never know, something might catch and could open a door, could get a bit of confidence from it, from himself, you know, and on we go again. And it benefits going into the Blackburn game. But, yeah, I don't know. I'm struggling a little bit front end of the pitch. I think I don't think you'd go Miles, would you? Because that would be tipping it too far the other way. I think you're probably going to have to err on the side. Maybe you bring on L back in. You know, he dipped him out on Saturday. Does he bring him back in and say, okay, prove me wrong, almost challenge and maybe bore our science, because I think he needs to get his season started as soon as, because we're all looking at him. We discussed it on the preview pod in a post-Gabby Zara world, subject to whatever they try and do on top of bringing in Forzan. He looks like a type of player who can at least offset some of what you lose with Gabby Zara going. But he was, you know, he wasn't great Saturday. He hasn't been great in pre-season. So he needs, a nice run out against, you would hope, lesser opposition to maybe get a little bit of confidence up. So that was a bit of a jumble, but you did put me on the spot, Connor. But I just hope, off the back of everything we've discussed about Oxford, and that it feels like the end of an era for a lot of these players, that we just don't see them on Tuesday, that, you know, that we actually use that while still wanting to progress in this competition, but it's used as a, no, okay, we've come in on a ticket of, we're going to play young players, we're going to trust young players, we believe there's talent in this club at youth levels, we're going to give them an opportunity. Within that, of course, you do need one or two more seasoned pros around them, but let's tip it more that end of the scale than what we saw when his 11 dropped on Saturday.
Yeah, agreed. And I think there's, certainly from my perspective, I'd rather see young players trying to implement a style of play and making mistakes rather than ones that perhaps we kind of know that's factored into their selection almost. Just on Gabe Forsyth, because you mentioned it, I've got the list in front of me here of Norwich City debutants in the Championship. In the Championship this century, basically. Obviously, there was football before the Championship was created. But in terms of purely the Championship, this is where Gabe Forsyth ranks. So you've got Chris Renton, who's still the youngest, 16 years, 9 months, 2 days. Mickey Spillane, who made his senior debut against Sheffield Wednesday in a 1-0 defeat in 2006. He was 17 years and 23 days. Rossi Jarvis, there is a bit of a theme here, I'm afraid. 2-0 defeat to Wolves in November 2005. He was 17 years, 7 months and 25 days. And then Bally Smart, who was a winger, wasn't he? South African. 2007, 3-0 defeat to Burnley. 17 years, 11 months and 21 days. And then you get to Gabe Forsyth, 18 years and 6 days. So a wonderful achievement for him. And hopefully the start of many more games for him. He did play some first-team football for Hamilton, it's worth saying. So not his senior debut, but his first-team debut for Norwich, which is good to see. Thank you very much for listening. We've had plenty to get through. We've managed to do it in just over an hour. So hopefully we've crammed everything in. I think it's going to be a busy week. We'll be at Carrow Road on both occasions this week. It's going to be a fascinating one, I think, both matches. So let's see how we go. Gents, thank you very much for joining me. Thank you all very much for listening and watching. And we'll see you again soon.
Here's golf legend John Daly.
Hell yeah, these wins are piling up faster than my divorces.
I only spent on Moto, America's social casino. You know I've won a couple of majors. And on Moto, I've won majors, grands, and epic jackpots on their classic Vegas slots with huge, huge bonus rounds. Moto Casino adds new games and awards players free coins every single day. Grip it and spin it on Moto Casino.
Download the Moto Casino app today. Moto Casino is a social casino. Void where prohibited. No purchase necessary. Visit Moto.us for more details.
Moto Casino. America's social casino.
Coda has turned up the frequency. Buses are running more often across Central Ohio. Starting this September, you'll see expanded weekend service on the east and north sides, including the Easton and Polaris corridors. Plus, there are added weekday trips downtown from New Albany, Canal, Winchester, and Tuttle. It's more service, more connections, and more ways to move across the city. Discover the enhanced schedule at coda.com/service changes. That's coda.com/service changes.
There's still time to get holiday ready. Right Rug Flooring makes it easy with next day installation and 24-month special financing with approved credit. Carpet, hardwood, luxury vinyl, and tile. We have everything you need to make your home shine for family and friends this season. Schedule a free in-home estimate or find a showroom near you. Visit rightrug.com. RITERUG.com. Be holiday ready with Right Rug Flooring.
Right Rug.